That's the voice of Elephant Gerald. Mine is the voice of Rick Cogan. Welcome to After Hours with me. We're in the Showcase studio. What do you think of this, Russ Bradbird? You
like good
this?
Music.
Yeah. Well. Yeah, so good music, idiot host. What are you going to do? Your latest book, we met each other after you had written a novel,
yes.
And which I admired tremendously. But this book, pal, All the Dreams We've Dreamed, A Story of Hoops and Handguns on Chicago's West Side, is a remarkable book. The story of, it is in many ways, Russ, the story of you, as well as a young man who you coached, who became the victim of, yet another victim of gun violence in Chicago. Since I'm going to keep you on for almost this entire hour, I'm going to start here, where you write, although I never played a minute of varsity basketball in high school, I played on the Frosh Soft team, and I knew even then what drew me to the game, that it was a window into black culture. Expand on that for me, Russ, will you? And welcome to the show, and it's great to see you.
Thank you, Rick. Yeah, it's good to see you again. Well, I think that, you know, I went to Chicago Public Schools for 11 of my 13 years, but when I got to Von Steuben High School, it had been integrated by busing. It was called permissive transfers back then. There were kids from the Austin district, and they were West Side kids.
Yeah.
And to a person, they were just really remarkable guys. They were, you know, interesting and smart and funny, and they had cool nicknames, and they were just really great to be around. And I immediately sort of identified with them and just felt like, geez, I just felt at home with them and felt happy and comfortable with them.
You know, it's a very interesting thing that the same kind of thing happened to Kevin Koval, who's a leading poet in town.
Sure, he does the Louder Than a Bomb.
Who could have created Louder Than a Bomb,
yeah.
Who has the People's History of Chicago's latest poetry book. He was something of a hotshot basketball player in Northfield and wound up and knew no black kids, certainly no inner city black kids growing up in Northfield, and wound up, I guess, as a junior in high school, coming down to Doug Collins' basketball camp where he was exposed to black Chicago, and it had a profound effect on him. You weren't a good player, but yet you became a coach. How does that happen?
Well, I think part of it is, you know, any just as any writer is someone who loves to read, and I think nearly all coaches were players who just couldn't imagine getting a real job. That's how I was. And so I just loved the game and liked being around kids and couldn't imagine doing anything else for a long time. But I think even from an early age, Rick, I was more interested in the stories than I was in the statistics or the plays, or I don't remember scores or statistics or out-of-bounds plays or zone offenses, but I remember the stories that were attached to things, and I think that's what I think eventually pulled me into the writing life.
Well, I also think you're a born storyteller, too. I mean, just this book is just, and thank God you're going to be here for an hour because we'll get into it. You became a coach, the youngest coach in the history of the Chicago Public League.
That's right. I went to North Park College, where I scored 13 career points in Division III.
You mean your picture's not on the wall there,
no,
Russ?
No, not at all. But they were great teams, and I got the bug pretty early. I wanted to be involved in basketball early. And at that time at Von Steuben, they had transferred the coach out at the last minute, and it was October, and somehow they'd transferred a coach out. And so I'd heard there was a coaching opening, so I just went and introduced myself to the principal and said, look, I just played right across the river is North Park. They're literally 300 yards apart. And talked him into letting me have a chance.
Coach by proximity. Then.
Well, that's right.
Yeah,
they knew who North Park was.
The neighborhood coach.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And so it opened the doors for me. And Von Steuben wasn't so much different then. It wasn't that many years later that I was there.
This book, All the Dreams We've Had, focuses on the West Side of Chicago, and specifically Marshall High School, the storied, another storied basketball power. Your first brush with Marshall was unfortunate. You lost by 63 points.
Yeah, didn't go well. But it was the mayor's tournament, and I remember it at one point counting the players. And I thought, this isn't, they've got six guys on the court. And how can this be? And I count one, two, three. And, but it was five of them, and they were swarming and quick and cohesive. And it wasn't just my players that couldn't figure out their press. I couldn't figure it out either. So I was always a little bit enamored with Marshall. It was the worst defeat I've ever been associated with, probably by 30 points.
It could be the worst of any, almost yes, any
it,
coach.
It was embarrassing. And Luther Bedford, of course, the coach who later appeared in Hoop Dreams, he was the coach at Marshall at that time, even.
The main, one of the, I think, two main characters in your book, Sean Harrington, had his 15 minutes of fame as kind of a minor player in the legendary documentary Hoop Dreams, made by Steve James here for Kirk Temkin Films. When did you first meet him?
When did I meet Sean Harrington?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I was doing a scouting service. In the early 90s, I was doing a scouting service, which was like a newsletter.
A subscription
yes.
kind of newsletter.
Dave Kaplan was my only competitor, and he was already sort of, you could tell, he had his eye on bigger and better things than writing a monthly newsletter. And so I was doing a scouting service, and I remembered Marshall, and, you know, from that shellacking that they gave me, and it was easy to get to. I was living right off Kedzie, where North Park is, and I could just zip down Kedzie and see Marshall against Westinghouse, Marshall against Manley, Marshall against Whitney Young. So I was at Marshall, and I thought it was a good gauge to see how good the teams were that I was scouting. And that's when I first saw Sean Harrington play. Basketball fans would remember that team as they had a 6'2" center, and at the time King High School had this couple 7-footers, and Marshall took him into overtime, nearly beat them. But Sean was clearly sort of the brains and the heart of that team.
Yeah. Yeah. How were you at the time treated as a white person going into those neighborhoods? There was always, when I was a kid and it was in the 60s, and I would go to, you know, the tournaments at the old amphitheater and stuff, it was, if you were going for ball, you were going for ball.
Yes.
And you didn't get hassled at
yes.
all.
I think I've never once had any trouble going into the West Side or South Side or North Side neighborhoods. And I think part of it is just, you know, the way you handle yourself and the way you walk and talk. And I don't look, you know, I didn't look scared, but I didn't look overconfident or cocky. I just never had any trouble. I think some of that is overblown. Although maybe things have changed since I was in the business, but I never had any trouble. And I think because I could talk the talk, you know, I had gone to Chicago Public Schools, had coached in the Chicago mm-hmm. Public League, and I could talk about ball. I couldn't talk about, there was plenty I couldn't talk about, but I think I understood the kids and what they'd been through and what they were going through. And there's something about, you know, public league credentials that I think go a long way.
You got, after you and Kaplan had your mano a mano, and you decided, well, this isn't really, I'm not going to make a living doing this, you decided to go back to coaching, right?
That's right, and that's when the New Mexico State job opened. I'd been coaching at University of Texas El Paso at
yeah.
UTEP, and we had a long list of Chicago players. But then when the job came open at New Mexico State, it was Gar Forman who left, who's now the general manager of the Bulls.
Right.
And so I took Gar Forman's job, and immediately, you know, any recruiter thinks the first thing you need, we've got to have a point guard. And I immediately, within hours of taking the job, I called Sean Harrington.
He said, I began phoning Sean at his junior college a few days after I started at New Mexico State. The one thing about Sean Bradford, about Sean Harrington that you, Coach Bradford, as he calls you, you sensed right away, you have one line in here that says, Sean was unusual, a genuinely warm, decent, and welcoming guy, as opposed to what?
Well, most Chicago players that I coached were hard, tough, gritty, edgy guys. And that carried over off the court often, too. But Sean could kind of turn it on and off, as he was, you know, he could be feisty and tough on the court. And then just the minute practice was over, the minute the games were over, it was, you know, he'd call it, I love you, man, give guys hugs in the locker room. And, you know, it was surprising, because it could come off as corny if you didn't know how genuine he was.
What, at the time, did you know much about his family?
No.
You really didn't.
No, yeah. No. And of course, his mother was still alive then, which we'll get to, I suppose.
Yeah,
but I knew he was from a single parent home, but which was typical. And you know, but he was a genuinely caring guy. And another example, Rick, is he'd go to the girl. I remember going to the women's game at New Mexico State once, and I showed up late because I didn't go to all of them. And there he was leading the, you know, stomping and getting right, everyone to stomp right, and cheer in unison. Right. I mean, it might have been 300 fans, but I thought, well, this is odd, because most of the players thought, you know, they only looked at the girls, girls' team.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, either as they could bed them down, or it's just someone that was taking up our gym
objects,
time. Yes, exactly.
Objects.
Or using our gym time, or
sure,
our equipment, or our trainers, or that kind of thing. But he was genuinely interested in the women's team, and that came from the girls, the bridge between the boys and girls teams at Marshall.
He is a remarkable guy, Sean Harrington, as you discover in this book. We got to take a little commercial break, but I'm going to keep Russ Bradbird here for the entire hour to talk about all the dreams we've dreamed, a story of hoops and handguns on Chicago's West Side, because it is an essential book for any Chicago bookshelf. Talking to Russ Bradbird about his astonishing book, All the Dreams We've Dreamed, a story of hoops and handguns on Chicago's West Side. It is a story, and we will get to it, of sort of an astonishing, courageous move that had tragic, I think, consequences, but there is a great deal of hope also in this book. You and Sean Harrington, who you recruited from Marshall High School to play in New Mexico, sort of drifted apart in August 1996, and you didn't see him again for 20 years. Did you hear of him? Did you keep tabs on him? No,
not at all. And, you know, it's one of the things that happens in major college sports is that, you know, the players come and players go. And he had somewhat of an unhappy ending at New Mexico State. He led the team in scoring,
right,
steals, and assists, but he blew out his knee. And so there's parts of the book, Rick, that we just don't agree on. And one of the parts we don't agree on is I feel like we did not renew his scholarship and didn't bring him back. But it was all done through innuendo. Don't you remember your high school girlfriend sort of stopped talking to you, and you saw her with that other fella?
Yeah.
And then you went to her and said, look, I've decided we're going to break up.
Right, sure.
But she'd already broken up with you. And my feeling was that we'd signed a couple players at his position, and he came to us and said, I think I'm going to transfer to Northwest Missouri. And we said, well, good luck.
Yeah.
And we didn't try to talk him into staying. Clearly we made a mistake. I mean, he went to Northwest Missouri, and he was the most valuable player in the entire conference. But I didn't talk to him until I'd heard that his mother was killed in 2003, which we can talk about. But
when he killed, how?
Well, she went to check on the neighbors, just looking in on the neighbors, and there was a home invasion in progress. Uh-huh. They had people duct taped, laying on the floor, hands yeah, tied behind their back. She tried to run out the house, and the people in the house miraculously lived, but she didn't. They shot her. You know, she was shot trying to escape from the house. She was exactly my age. I think she was 43 when she died, something like that, 48 maybe.
Yeah. Could Sean have used that later college experience to perhaps, as many non-NBA players, of which there are millions of non-NBA players, to play in Europe, to have a career in basket as a player?
Absolutely. He was good enough to play. You know, we'd gone to Australia as a team.
Which yeah,
Australia,
right.
Australia was one of the few countries that has American point guards. So he could have gone overseas, I'm certain of it. But his college girlfriend high school girlfriend turned up pregnant. And he did what we always stress to young men to do in our society.
Do the right thing.
Yeah, go be a good father to your... So rather than go overseas and play, rather than leave Chicago, he came back to Chicago to be a good father to his daughter.
All right, before I get to what happened to Sean in 2014 and what then brought you two back together in a much different relationship, what fascinates me about the book is your initial relationship is coach and high school kid, and the later relationship is author and subject, two vastly different kinds of relationships. Is he upset? Does he feel with recriminations about doing the right thing and coming back to Chicago? Is this? It doesn't seem as if he's a guy who would beat himself up too much about that.
I don't think so. I think, you know, it's a common question, Rick, is people have asked me, why did he come back to Chicago if he didn't have to? He had a degree, and why doesn't he get off the West Side? And the answer I always give about that is that, you know, Martin Luther King might still be alive today if he'd just moved to Seattle and been a used car salesman instead of, you know, or if he'd have sold insurance in Atlanta and got out of the whole preaching business. And so I do think what he did, I think in many ways what Sean did before he ever saved his daughter's life in 2014, I think what he did in when he came back in 1998 was heroic. He came back to, you know, to the West Side.
Yeah. Well, and to sort of help and nurture and foster and do the right thing, not only by the child he had and by the woman who had had that child, but by the people growing up in that neighborhood.
That's right. And by the kids at Marshall High School. And so I think there's an element of heroism just in that, in going back.
No question.
And not everybody on the West Side can move off the West Side.
Yeah. No. I mean, as you well know.
And he grew up in grinding poverty. You know, he'd lived in five or six different homes by the time he ever went to high school. Although he had a good, I think one of the great things that he's had in his life is he had a really, his mother was a really wonderful lady.
But he also, in that short time, and we both know what has happened to the West Side and various portions of the South Side in these years, it's not gotten any better. I mean, he's going to New Mexico and then somewhere else to play basketball. By the time he came back, it's the same place and maybe worse.
That's right. That's
more
right.
Disenfranchised.
That's right. But I also think the other element, I think, Rick, is that home is still home. You know, and I think that I think that's part of it too. Is even though, you know, he's never had any interest in applying at other schools, or, you know, he loves Marshall and he loves the neighborhood and he loves those kids, and it would never occur to him to go be the coach at South Shore High School,
or
a suburban high school, or Fenwick Catholic, or that kind of thing. It just wouldn't occur to him because he's so loyal to Marshall and to his neighborhood.
While you were apart, he spent time there as he was a teacher's aide and a basketball coach, and he knew that school as well as he knew the palm of his hand. He couldn't find his car on January 14, 2014. What happened to him?
Well, his car was stolen by a Marshall student, and so the stolen car led to him, you know, he wound up in a rental car, and a couple weeks later, in the rental car, driving his daughter to Westinghouse High School, you know, then he would drop the daughter off at Westinghouse and go on to Marshall, but he's in a rental car, just a nondescript, common, you know, four-door white, sedan. And it's 7:30 in the morning, and these guys run up. It's just a mistaken identity. They thought he was somebody else, ran up to his car at the corner of Augusta and Hamlin.
Mm-hmm.
So pretty close to what would be Division and Pulaski.
Yeah.
Pretty close to Orr High School, actually, which is Chicago and Pulaski. But ran up to his car and just opened fire. And he dove on top of his daughter, pushes her down, and a bullet goes through her headrest. So she undoubtedly would have been shot in the face. But he takes two bullets. He takes two bullets, one in the back. And he knew that something was wrong. And that was one of the really amazing parts of the story, is the daughter said, you know, are we shot? Are we shot? She was panicked and yelling. There's glass all over the place, glass in her hair. And he says, no, we're fine, which I think is a really, really. First, there's the pushing her down to get her out of the way, get her out of the line of fire and covering her body, but also calming her and saying.
Well, the courage is both physical and emotional in this case. I mean, it's really stunning to me the way you capture it, too.
You're fine. Let's call your mother, and then, you know, call your mom, tell her we're fine. You know, let's call 911, that kind of thing. But even then, he could feel his legs floating up felt like his legs were floating up. You know, the car wound up bouncing over the curb across the street, and he could have got T-boned. You know, he was lucky not to get hit again.
And he is severely damaged.
That's right. He's paralyzed from the waist down. Although occasionally, you know, it's exciting for him. He gets hunger pangs now, and occasionally his foot will twitch or his leg will twitch. I think he still holds out hope. And, you know, with medical technology these days, anything is possible. But it appears that he's paralyzed.
You heard about this.
Yes. It was all over the radio.
And then you decided to do what?
Well, I texted him. which is about the dumbest thing you can do to somebody who's been shot and is in the hospital, as if they, you know, as if people want to get a text from a coach they haven't seen
coach
in 20
years. Coach you
haven't
seen or talked to in 20 years.
But then, after about a week.
What did your text say?
I said, big love from New Mexico. You know, I'm teaching down at New Mexico.
Yeah, right,
State,
right,
now,
right.
Where I used to coach. And about a week later, I just said, well, I'll just call him. You know, and he answered the phone. It surprised me. And he said that Dorothy Gators, the famous girls coach, was putting on a benefit game. And I just blurted it out. I'll be there.
I'm in.
Not knowing what I was getting into. And so I spent the first year, I had this idea that, you know, I've met you before, and I know some media people in Chicago and some basketball media people. And I had the idea that if we can get people to write about his story, that will help with the fundraising, because I knew, you know, his paychecks got cut off after 90
right,
days.
Right, I know. The bureaucracy at the public school system
yes.
is really...
And they're, in fairness, they're not under the same... Because he's not a teacher. He's educational support personnel.
Right.
So he's under a different... He's with a different union. And so his paychecks got cut off pretty quickly. And my idea was, I'll advocate for him. I'll bang on doors. And the more that it got ignored, you know, Dan McGrath was good. He wrote a piece about it. Dawn Trice Turner, she wrote a nice piece. But in general, it was just ignored. And I had people tell me, this is a good story.
Why I was ignored. Yeah,
because it happens all the time.
Yeah.
And this is a good story.
Well, a black guy getting shot.
Yes.
And that's, we'll talk about that. I know you're intrigued by all this, and as am I. All the dreams we've dreamed. Story of Hoops, Handguns on Chicago's West Side. I will continue my conversation with Russ Bradford about his remarkable book and, indeed, this remarkable story. Russ Bradford is in here for 20 more minutes. He and I will be with Sean Harrington at the Printers Row Lit Fest this coming Saturday in Jones College Prep in the third floor library, which is a really nice space. And I so look forward to meeting Sean and asking him, as I'm asking you, did you do him justice? It's a tough book. I mean, it's a tough... You came back, you wanted to go to a benefit for him, you wanted to try to help him in a way, and then all of a sudden you started saying, wait a minute, maybe I should write... And the story is unbelievably compelling. I would have thought the same thing. But you're biting off a lot in doing this.
Well, I think sometimes we can't write about things because we're too close. You know, when the Herman Cogan biography comes out, it won't be Rick Cogan that does it, I don't think, would it?
No.
Okay.
The Rick Cogan autobiography comes out, that's not going to be either.
I just thought I was too close to the situation.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But I kept trying to advocate for him and trying to get publicity for him. And when I finally sat down with Alex Kotlowitz, you know Alex.
Oh, of course.
And
there are no children.
Alex finally said to me, he sort of put me on the spot, and he made me pretty uncomfortable the way a good interviewer can sometimes. And he said, well, you know, finally he said, you know, you say that you wake up in the morning thinking about Sean, you go to bed at night thinking, what can I do to help him tomorrow? Why don't you write this yourself?
Yeah.
And by that point, I had pages and pages of notes, and I'd been trying to write a magazine piece because I thought maybe
someone... Had you moved back to Chicago by then?
No. I teach at New Mexico State, but I live in Ravenswood in the summers. We have a tiny apartment, and we have a great situation. We rent it out to graduate students during the year, and we leave sheets and blankets and coffee cups and everything and just move in for 3 months in the summer. So I've been coming back. It was the thing that I missed most about coaching, is it took me away from Chicago.
Yeah.
But when I started teaching, when I got out of coaching, we got this tiny apartment there, and it pays the mortgage, the renters. But Kotlowitz had said to me, why don't you write it yourself? And it seemed obvious. You know, now it seems obvious.
Looking back at the time, no question.
I was resisting and didn't think I was... It just seemed like a lot of work. And it's not the happiest story in the world either.
No, it's not. No, it's not. And to dig deeper into Ravenswood is, although you do know the city, Russ Bradford, very, very well, but... Ravenswood is a vastly different neighborhood.
No,
you would drive
leafy.
Your bike down. I mean, you would ride your bike down.
Yes,
you would commute.
Yes, I was cycling from Ravenswood after Sean was shot, after he was paralyzed, he moved in with an aunt in Oak Park. But I'd have to, you know, there's no easy way to get to Oak Park, and on the bike, it's a bit of a haul. But yeah, so I was cycling, but you know, I've got my bright yellow vest and my bright yellow helmet and my lights. I look like
a crazy construction worker or a lunatic.
I look like a nut.
Yeah.
And so no one ever, I'm like a rolling pinball machine.
But in doing this, too, you got some incredible insights that that you write in here. I'm going to read something you wrote, if you don't mind. You write, many Chicagoans ignore the situation, meaning the situation of violence in certain neighborhoods here, or tune it out as I once did in order to simply move forward and not spend their days weeping in a closet. On the West Side, that's impossible. There, violence can't be contained in the morning paper or the nightly news. To most of those in safe neighborhoods, the epidemic over there and to them and is an acceptable level of violence. Did you feel terribly removed from the reality of neighborhoods like Austin and Garfield Park and West Garfield? Well, of course you did.
Now that I'm not coaching anymore, yeah. I had no reason to go over there anymore.
Right.
And so, I think that's it. I do think that's it is an acceptable level of violence in America and in Chicago, or else we would stop it.
Well, in the course of this book, you also write about other Marshall students and basketball players who fell victim.
You remember, Rick, I bet you remember the great writer Grace Paley.
Absolutely.
Who wound up in jail a half dozen times for protesting this and that. But she said once that you don't really have a story until you have two stories.
Yeah.
When in the Sean Harrington story, I was working on it about a year after Sean was shot. Tim Triplett, the star player for Marshall, was murdered.
Yeah.
And that's when the book really, it almost spun out of control, but that's when it really took off, I think. Is that Triplett was a really compelling and charismatic guy, and his story was very much like Sean. He'd had a parent murdered.
Mm-hmm.
His father had been murdered, then his brother had been murdered, and he had bounced around a lot as a kid, but he was a energetic, talented point guard, very much like Sean was. Sean wasn't quite as cocky as Tim Triplett was, but what made Tim Triplett a great player, the theory that I come up with in the book is that was his undoing also. You know, Sean could turn it on and off.
Yeah.
And many of the great ones can. You know, I worked for Lou Henson for a few years.
Sure, sure, sure.
And Lou, as soon as the game was over, he was hugging everybody and smiling and shaking hands. In the game, he was like George Foreman. You know, George Foreman seems like the nicest person in the world. He'd try and knock your head off.
Yeah, exactly.
He'd
try to kill you.
And I think with Tim Triplett, that was when the book really sort of really took off, and there was these two stories. Here was Sean Harry, you know, Tim Triplett had this secret life. He was trying to make ends meet on the street, but was also a great player. And soon after Triplett was killed, one Marshall player after another was killed. And
I
now,
know.
As 2 days ago, Rick, no, 2 weeks ago, a kid named Cedric Williams was killed, and he'd played 3 years in Marshall. That makes the seventh Marshall player killed in a three-year period.
Well, Triplett is a compelling person, too. There's one section where you're talking about his postings on Facebook that started to sort of, it was a manifestation of him going a little
nuts. He was conflicted. I mean, on the one hand, he loved basketball, he loved his girlfriend, he loved his mother. But, you know, he had there was no money, and I think the
right.
street life sort of gave him access to money that he wouldn't have had. But part of what I think what was so compelling about Triplett to Sean Harrington is that he spotted him pretty early, thought, this guy's going to be a coach. He's smart, and he's talented, and he's outspoken. Even before he got eligible at Marshall, he would be. There's no vocal leader on the team who's not playing in the game. If you watch Chris Paul when he was hurt for the Rockets a week or two ago, sure, he talks to the refs a little bit and that, but he's not trying to run the team. Triplett was trying to run the team.
Wow, interesting. So Sean had you write, and some of the stuff in this book, Russ, is so chilling. When you write here, Sean was in a rut. The $850 a day rehab price tag was no longer covered by Sean's insurance company. Fearful of draining his savings, he stopped going. That meant he could not get approved by doctors to return to work at a job he could no longer do. That is one of the saddest paragraphs I can remember
reading. It was a real catch-22. Is he couldn't get his health insurance to kick in again until he started work, and he couldn't work because he couldn't do the rehab, so he was sort of stuck in this rut. And that's one of the things, that one of the angles of the book in All the Dreams We've Dreamed, Rick, is Tim Triplett had a secret life. He was a basketball star that was doing things at night that he probably shouldn't have been doing. Sean Harrington has a secret life, too. He knows Shaquille O'Neal, he knows Nolan Richardson, he knows Tim Hardaway, but most days he's stuck in his apartment.
Yeah.
And can't get out. And I think his secret life is the real great challenge, I think, for him is the endurance to go on for the next 30 years.
How's his daughter?
She's good, but she's had ups and downs too.
Well, I'll bet. You know, well, the PTSD that you know, I'm no doctor, but both of these two must be suffering that at some level. Yes.
I think one of the things that I had hoped, and I think a lot of people had hoped, is that if Sean will just get better one day. But it's going to be with him for the, of course, this incident will be with him for the rest of his life. And I think for the daughter, too. You know, she was number 3 in her high school class when the shooting happened, and her grades dipped all the way to 3.5. Well, you know, so not terribly.
Yeah, but.
I mean, she's a remarkable kid as well. And that's, if you remember this part in the book, you know, she's shy and she's not as outgoing or as boisterous as Sean is. But then at the trial, she sort of saved
the
day.
Right. All the Dreams We've Dreamed, a story of hoops and handguns on Chicago's West Side by Russ Bradberg. It is an unbelievable story. He and I will be at the Printers Row Lit Fest this coming Saturday, third floor library at Jones College Prep, further talking about this, and I will get to meet Sean, and Russ and I will continue the conversation after a short commercial break, during which I will first tell you, Steve is giving away a Centennial Blue Chevy Silverado truck. Have they let Sandberg take a spin behind the wheel yet? Tune in tomorrow at 7:20 a.m. for details. Welcome back. I have only 10 more minutes left with Russ Bradberg talking about his remarkable book, All the Dreams We've Dreamed, a story of hoops and handguns on Chicago's West Side. It is a story of tragedy, but I also think one of some hope in telling these stories, and you're telling about the number of kids at Marshall, in addition to Sean Harrington, who had been shot and killed in that neighborhood. You quote Arne Duncan in this book, the former head of schools here and the former head of education for the Obama administration. One day he sent you 3 texts that combined said this, quote, Black lives don't matter. We can say they do, but our collective actions don't match the words. In fact, quite the opposite. If these were white folks being killed in Chicago, everything would change. You believe that, Russ?
I think it's true. I think that you know, one of the things I've struggled with, you know, trying to explain to friends the Black Lives Matter situation, and I do think that nothing ruins a neighborhood more than an unsolved murder, unless it's a closing of a school.
Or 50 schools.
Yes. And so in this case, though, you know, Sean's shooters were caught pretty quickly.
Yeah.
But he was a celebrity, you know, comparatively.
He's a
high school basketball star and a coach and that kind of thing. Of the other 7 players who have been killed, there's no arrests that have ever been made, even with Tim Triplett. I started off. I've become much more sympathetic to the cops than I was when I started the book.
Sure.
But when there's unsolved murders, you know, that's where the whole Black Lives Matter thing manifests itself to me, is that let's solve these murders if those lives mattered. And I think the truth of it, Rick, is it's poor black people.
Oh yeah.
If this was happening to Oak Park kids or Evanston kids, it would be a very different story.
You spent enough time in these neighborhoods, Russ, to know that there are neighborhoods in Chicago that are disenfranchised, and you could convince someone, take them there blindfold, you convince them they were in rural Mississippi in the 60s.
Well, one of the things I tried not to do in the book was, you know, to offer solutions. I thought the book would just get totally too big. It would be 700 pages if I tried to offer solutions, and so I don't want to offer solutions. But now on the West Side today, 80% of the kids don't go to their neighborhood school.
I know,
and that's a kind of craziness. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, if things were going bad for me at Von Steuben, my mother knocked on the principal's door and said, my son can't pass his Spanish class.
And for Arne Duncan's great quotes in the book, and also his great jacket quote, I mean, Arne's a big believer in charter schools, and I'm not a big believer
in charter schools.
Either.
And I've never challenged him on that. And that was actually part of the – when I finally got through to Arne Duncan, I thought, should I challenge him on this charter school stuff, or do I just try and help Sean Harrington? I just thought, all right, Russ,
the wise choice, and I think another wise choice you made is in trying to offer solutions. Many of these problems are deep seated.
Yes.
They're not. I'm not going to say they're insoluble, but they are so deep seated. These neighborhoods have been so disenfranchised that, okay, if you and I were Bill Gates and we could go build factories and put people to work, and maybe in a few generations this might be some kind of what you have done. And the cover really captures it too. You've written about the desperation and hopelessness, but also the courage that exists in these neighborhoods.
Well, and I think if there's any redemption in the book, it's, you know, in Sean Harrington's courage and endurance. But also, you know, I remember, and I write about this in the book, I spent a full day at Marshall one day, and one of the first things I saw was the cops tasering a kid. Have you ever seen anyone get tasered?
Oh, yeah.
It's shocking.
Oh, it's horrifying.
I mean, well, there's a pun there, sorry.
Yeah.
But
it's horrifying.
Was really surprising, and it really rattled me. And I thought, why would anybody send their kid here? And I'd been to Marshall dozens of times at that point, but
Marshall's not the worst.
No, but every kid who walked by in the hallway, a teacher spoke to that kid and knew every kid's first name. Hey, Joe. Hello, Diane. Hey, Stacy.
Yeah.
They knew every kid. Every teacher knew every kid by first name. And all, you know, there's a whole crew of people at Marshall that have no interest in getting better jobs at better schools. They love Marshall and love those kids.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you experienced that, because I'm not gonna lie, I know a lot of teachers out there, and they are the ones fighting the good fight. Because you asked yourself, why did Sean Harrington come back to the West Side? Why do these people stay? Why do these people go to work on the West Side?
Yes.
It is because they are optimistic. They are hopeful. They see in a kid reading his first poem, they see something bright in their eyes.
That's right. That's right. People have commended me for saying, it's really great what you've done for Sean. But what I did for Sean, I think there's people, that's why I don't want to try to appear to be an expert. There's people who have dedicated their lives to helping kids.
Yeah.
They're called Chicago public school teachers.
Exactly. You don't come off as an expert here.
Yeah.
You come off as a storyteller You have found a very, very compelling character upon which to, and a heroic character upon which to hang this story, which is a much bigger story that, you know, there is no, you know, there was a, you know, in the days of, you know, Isaiah Thomas, there was a way out. Or so there seemed.
Yes.
There doesn't seem to be that way anymore.
No,
I'm sure there's some kid who's going to, you know, who's going to beat the odds, but, you know, that whole...
But even that, with the chances of getting a basketball scholarship are no matter how hard you work. And so we need other things besides basketball for kids to latch on to. I love the movie Hoop Dreams, and I watched it again for about the fifth time last summer.
Sure.
It holds up. But the one thing that worries me about Hoop Dreams, I think people who don't know the neighborhood see it and think, isn't it great? Basketball gave these kids a way out. But the truth is that most kids aren't going to be good enough basketball players.
Well, most kids. It's the fast.
Yes,
fast.
99% of the kids are not getting scholarships.
Yeah, let alone playing in the
NBA. I can't wait for you to meet Sean Harrington
NBA.
In Printer's Row.
How is he now?
Well, it's been...
And how is he? What does he think of the book? And did you two... this is in a sense, not a classic collaboration, but it's a collaborative effort here, I think.
Well, he never saw the book till I was done. I did that on purpose because I knew there would be things that he didn't like in the book. Hey, he doesn't think he's a hero. He says, I did what any parent would do, but I'd like to think I would react like that, but I don't know if I would. I don't think we know how we would react till the bullets start flying, but I think it's the struggles have continued for him. I think he's anxious about his two daughters, you know. Mm-hmm. He's anxious about the daughters, and he wants to, you know, Arnie Duncan helped him get that restorative justice counselor job at Marshall, but he's had health reasons, and he's battled depression a little bit, and he hasn't been working full-time, so he's hoping to go back to work full-time in September.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
That's good. I cannot wait to meet him. Again, Russ and I will be with the aforementioned Sean Harrington, I'm going to call him a hero. You can do whatever he wants to me. I'll call him a hero in the book. And at the third floor library at Jones College Prep as part of the Printer's Row Lit Fest, which takes place all weekend, Saturday and Sunday. We will be at Saturday at 1 o'clock, third floor library at Jones College Prep. It is a space filled with light, and I hope that light is coming into Sean Harrington's life. Where does he live now?
He's on the edge of the West Side. He's in Oak Park and lives with his aunt. And so that's part of the difficulty too. Is I think that's the next step for him. He can't get in and out of the apartment on his own. And so I think that's the next step, is we've got to figure out a way to somehow get him in with an elevator. Covered parking,
yeah.
You know that, because he has a van now. He has a wheelchair accessible van.
You may have split apart for 20 years, you two guys, you and Sean Harrington. But I figure now, Russ Bradbird, you and he are tied at the hip for.
Well, that's what Conroy said. Is you know, when I had lunch with John Conroy a couple weeks ago, he had mentioned that. And I hope so too. You know, I say this at the end of the book, is that like any coach, I had done poorly by him, I think, for many years, and I think like any coach, you know, I want the next season to start.
You've done right by him in this book. This is just a remarkable book. All the dreams we've dreamed, story of hoops and handguns on Chicago's West Side. I will add to that alliterative title, story of hoops and handguns and hope. I will also add on Chicago's West Side. I will see you Saturday.
Great, Rick.
Rest up.
Okay.
We'll do the same. Why don't we just sit there and we'll play portions of this and let Sean talk?
Yeah. Well, wait till you meet. He's a good talker, too.
I can't wait. I just can't wait. I'm so glad he's coming to this thing, too. Once again, at Jones College Prep, Saturday, 1 o'clock in the library on the third floor. It will be the three of us talking further about this. I can't wait to meet him. And you've done him proud here, and I'm going to tell him that, too.
Thank you a lot, Rick.
My pleasure.